Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name's Olivia Rosenman, and this week we're in conversation with Tracy Spicer, whose career as a journalist, TV newsreader, and broadcaster spans three decades. Tracy's new book, The Good Girl Stripped Bare, looks back over her life and her career and shines an unwavering light on the sexism and misogyny in the industry. The book is brutally honest in describing the inner workings of TV news under a leadership of mostly old men. It's a memoir, and I think it's fair to describe it as a manifesto for women in the workplace. It's also an interesting chronicle of Australian history and politics in the past 30 years. Tracy, the book is a pleasure to read. It is blunt in its descriptions, wise in its conclusions. It's sometimes incredibly funny and sometimes devastating. It's conversational, it's personal, and I was also delighted to finally find someone who shares my love of writing with a liberal use of capital letters for emphasis. So can you tell us, why did you decide to write the book?
Well, thank you for those kind words. This is a book that I didn't want to write. The publisher, HarperCollins, approached me about writing a memoir, and I didn't really want to necessarily write my life story because I think there are so many other stories that need to be told in society. But I decided to use my own trajectory, my career, 30 years in the Australian media, as a framework around which to speak about the history of feminism and the challenges women still face in the workplace.
You studied journalism at the Queensland Institute of Technology in the 80s, and your observation then was that around 9 of 10 of your peers were women. I studied journalism in this decade, and that was certainly still the case among my cohort. Women do make up around half of the journalism industry, but looking around at the heads of the country's major media and news organisations, there's not many women there. A 2013 study by the University of the Sunshine Coast found that 70% of senior managers and editors-in-chief were men. So where are all the women at the top of the industry?
I often think about this. I graduated in 1987, and I think a whole generation of women has disappeared from the industry. Most of them, I believe, have left because of the wallpaper of misogyny. There was an awful lot of bullying, particularly in the 80s and 90s, and a lot of that culture still continues in some commercial newsrooms these days. So many women have decided to do PR instead, or content journalism, branded journalism, is where a lot of women are going now because they don't like the sexist structures in the newsroom. We also see this real picture of middle-aged white men as managers. In fact, of the 30 big media organisations in Australia, only 2 to 3 of the heads are women, and that's a terrible indictment on the industry.
Let's talk about pay, which is another issue for women in journalism. Census data released this week showed that women across the board are paid on average $119 a week less than men. And the most recent statistics from the Workplace and Gender Equality Agency showed that women working in information, media and telecommunications earn 18.5% less than men. Now, you confess in the book that in 14 years working at Channel 10, you never once asked for a pay rise. And I think you're pretty open about describing that as a mistake. Do you think that part of closing the gender pay gap is working out how to support and better encourage women to, in fact, demand better pay?
This is a really complex area, so I want to take a little bit of time on it. It's a combination of structural discrimination and the fact that a lot of us suffer from the good girl syndrome, which is what my book is about. Women of my era, I turned 50 this year, were brought up to sit there quietly, be the glue in men's conversations, bring out the tea and scones, and never ever talk about the nasty business of money. And that is compounded with being in workplaces where a boss, in my case at Channel 10 in Brisbane, said to me, "Oh, you don't need a pay rise. You'll work here for a couple of years and then you'll marry a nice businessman and you'll never have to work another day in your life again." A lot of us internalise that misogyny and then think we are not welcome in the workplace and we don't deserve to earn more money. So by the stage where someone actually did come to me for contract negotiation at Channel 10 in Sydney, I'd internalised that sexism so much that I said, "No, please, I don't deserve any more money." So there's a lack of transparency. There's a graduate gender pay gap of around about $5,000 in the first year out of university between men and women. So what we're seeing is structural from the get-go, that employers do look at even a young man and say, "Well, that's a much better employee than that young woman."
Your 14-year career as a journalist and news anchor at Channel 10 ended when you were fired via email 2 months after the birth of your second child. In your book, you describe this as having ignited a fire in you, and you took the decision to take legal action. Was that a difficult decision to make? And what was it that brought you to the point where you were ready to fight?
I'd seen so many of my female colleagues being sidelined or sacked once they committed the crime of having children. We used to have going away parties for people who became pregnant, not maternity leave parties. And I thought that the injustice was absolutely outrageous. Someone needed to draw a line in the sand, and I knew that I was in a privileged position where I had the finances and I had the emotional support to be able to stand up and say, no, this is enough. I also knew, being a journalist, that not only would I start a conversation in our industry, I was able to start a media campaign to talk to women all across Australia, because we know even to this day, one in two women experience pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. So when they said to me, you can sign this press release saying you've chosen to leave for family reasons, it took about a millisecond to say, no, I'm not going to lie to the public. I'm going to start talking more about the way women are treated in the workplace.
As you said, one in two women still experience discrimination after returning from maternity leave. I think age discrimination is still something that happens very regularly, much more regularly to women than to men. Would you encourage more women, if they do have the strength, the finances and the support that came together to help you be able to take that fight and make it legal, would you encourage more women to do that?
Yes, we need to tell our stories, because there's still a certain part of the Australian population that believes this is no longer a problem. And unless we share our stories and hold employers to task, things aren't going to change. That's not to say it's the women's fault. The fault is the structure in the system. But we need to make people aware of what's happening. Having said that, it's not easy. I would recommend every woman, even before she thinks about having children, if she's in paid employment, does the research, looks at the state and federal legislation, union regulation, looks at the company's policies on maternity leave. There are a couple of businesses that are springing up, like the Grace Papers, which are specifically there to advise women about a strategy around taking maternity leave so when they return at an equal level. This is how much of a problem it's become. We really have to, it's like a war, we have to plan a strategy for it.
This year's Sydney Writers' Festival is bursting with talent, including some of the literary world's brightest and most respected names. Festival guests include great Irish novelist Anne Enright, 2017 Pulitzer Prize winner Colson Whitehead, New York Times best-selling author Roxane Gay, acclaimed author George Saunders, and Pulitzer Prize winning writer Susan Faludi. May 22-28, info at swf.org.au. Sydney Writers' Festival, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
I guess I'll have to change my plans.
On May 27, you may well have to change your plans if you don't want to miss the 2SER Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon. 2SER's celebration of all things Bob will go for 8 hours and feature news, reviews, interviews, the Bob Dylan quiz, and all the Bob songs that fit, starting at 8 p.m. and going through till 4 in the morning. The Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon on 2SER, May 27 from 8 p.m. 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music, and Bob.
It's a hard rain, they're gonna fall.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. A recent report by the Institute of Family Studies shows that stay-at-home dads spend less time on childcare than their working wives and take on only slightly more housework than mothers working a 35-hour week. How can we begin to address sexism in the workplace when it seems that gender roles are still deeply entrenched in the home?
I write in the book that equality starts in the lounge room before the boardroom, and it's so true. I read that full study and found it fascinating. I think what we're seeing there is, because when women have children, the workplace isn't really ready for men to take paternity leave. Men are still judged for taking time off to care for their children because we have such a masculine culture. And because women spend so much time around small children, we become more adept at dealing with them, at managing the housework. And because the father doesn't have that bonding time when the kids are young and managing all the housework as well, they become less accustomed to doing it, and they become more entrenched as the worker, and the woman becomes more entrenched back at home. We really see a 1950s trend when families are formed in Australia, and that's exactly what this study shows. I don't believe for a second that men are deliberately shirking their responsibilities. I just think we have this belief in Australia that the man is the boss at work and the woman is the boss at home, and it's really hard to break that down.
Let's return to the TV news industry, because at the end of the book you write that the era of newsreaders as talking heads is almost over. So I wonder, what changes are you seeing? And if your daughter said that she wanted to follow in your footsteps and become a TV newsreader, how would you feel about that?
Oh, that's a tricky question. My son really wants to be a journalist. He loves writing, and my daughter's got an incredibly massive scientific brain. I would be devastated if she didn't become a scientist or something like that. She's very strong in science and maths, so I don't think it would suit her persona. Insofar as young women going into the industry, I think there are great opportunities now. I see more cultural diversity, I see more age diversity, and I do think the day of the greying man looking concerned and slightly constipated as half man, half desk back from the 1980s, you know, is no longer there. I'm seeing a lot of different images on television, so I'm actually quite optimistic about the future.
You also shared experiences in the book of reporting on domestic violence in the early 90s, or perhaps I should say not reporting on domestic violence. It was considered something that was private and not for the news. I think it's fair to say that has changed to a large extent. We definitely see a lot more reporting of domestic violence. But do you think there are still ways that we could improve?
There are so many ways we could improve. I am heartened that we have moved on from those days when I was at 3AW in Melbourne and told not to cover the Code 10 because what goes on behind closed doors stays behind closed doors. That was reprehensible of the media at that time. Now, though, even though we're reporting on it more, there's two issues. Number one, it's becoming more evident. People are talking about it, but there still aren't enough places in women's refuges for women and children, for the victims. But also, we're still seeing a lot of victim blaming. In some of the language in the headlines, there's a lot of, oh, poor man, he was driven to do this because of various other circumstances, rather than this man killed his wife and children and he is an offender, rather than making excuses for him.
One of your bosses at Channel 9, I believe, told you that no one wants to hear about the two A's, AIDS and Aborigines. It's too depressing, was what he said. I mean, that's reprehensible. I wonder, are there any topics in today's newsroom that there's a similar attitude to?
Oh, it's a really good question. We are talking about a lot more topics these days, and part of that is the proliferation of technology and globalisation. We're more aware of what's happening overseas. But the other thing my boss said to me at that time, all those decades ago, it was a colleague actually at Channel 9 in Melbourne, said that, you know, the death of one whitey equals 1,000 black people, which is just an appalling thing to say. But I still see that in commercial television news services, where we will get terribly upset about something that affects a small number of people in a developed country compared with something affecting perhaps 4 million people in Syria. So sadly, I still see that real structural racism, which is what it is, underlying a lot of our news these days.
You tell what is, I'm sure it wasn't funny at the time, but is now a funny anecdote about your first time on the screen where you fainted twice.
Not just once, I went back and did it again.
And I think I want to look at what happened a few months ago with Natasha Exelby on ABC News 24 when she was caught unawares coming back to the screen fiddling with her pen. I just wonder that this turned into a huge web phenomenon. Rumours circulated that she was fired, a petition circulated to get her job back. It was a big deal. I just wonder, if she had been a man, would there have been such a fuss?
Oh, that is a really good question. I've spoken to Tash about this a lot since. She's a very strong young woman, and look, she's gone onward and upward since then, so it's fine. I think that, no, I don't think there would have been such a level of criticism if it was a man. I think there's still this underlying thing about women on television that, they might be a little bit vague, or they're a bit young, or they're not very focused on the job. There is that narrative about women in the workforce. So I do think she was unfairly pilloried. honestly, having worked in a 24-hour television news environment, it is incredibly difficult. And it's really easy just to have a moment where you lose your focus. The other thing is, with all the cutbacks, there aren't the floor managers there used to be. There isn't the count in your ear as frequently as it used to be. So often you're sitting up there for 6 hours straight. I know we're not digging ditches, but you're concentrating 100%. It's so easy to lose a moment of concentration and then something like that happens.
So let's talk about that more, the 24-hour newsroom, because another thing that I found very interesting in the book was you wrote about covering 9/11, and that was one of the first times that Channel 10 had used rolling coverage. In your career in TV news, the technology has changed very dramatically, and how has that impacted on the work?
In a way, it's made it easier. In a way, it's made it more difficult. And what we're talking about here is fake news, of course. When we started being able to use Twitter as a source, it was tremendous when we could go to a primary source on Twitter. When, for example, in the Brisbane floods, the Queensland Police were tweeting out life-saving information much more quickly than the once-an-hour press conferences. That's really important to get on top of. And it was great to be at Sky News at the time when we could start having our devices on set and being able to bring things to people much more quickly. But then it exploded, new media, which is tremendous, and it was really hard to get those primary sources and to work out whether vision was legitimate or not. And in a 24-hour news environment, you really don't have the time to do the proper checks that journalists should do. So I still have a problem with this 24-hour news environment and not only the fake news, but the incorrect news that goes out routinely. There simply aren't the checks and balances that there should be.
You described Twitter as a colleague, a lover, and a friend. But Twitter is also a place where women are targeted by trolls, and you have experienced that yourself. So I wonder if a better description might be that Twitter is kind of like a bad boyfriend that you keep going back to. Or have you, in fact, worked out a way to stay safe and comfortable online?
It's taken me a long time, but I've worked out some strategies of managing it. And a lot of that is taking control by blocking or muting, or if people are starting to have a bit of a go at you and you think, oh, they might be able to be convinced, giving them the information. But then when they start wasting your time, then saying, thank you very much, but no thanks. I'm not going to spend any more of my valuable time on this conversation. A lot of it is that people pleasing, to be honest with you, and the good girl syndrome, where I tried to communicate with everybody, and then when I was attacked, I thought, oh no, you know, I blamed myself, the victim. I was like, oh no, maybe I haven't explained myself properly, so I'd go back and explain myself again. Now I understand that it's the mob mentality. Some people are deliberately out there to get others. It's the modern day version of trying to silence women, which has been happening since the days of Homer's Odyssey, Penelope being told speech will be the business of men. So now I understand the signs when the mob attacks, and I'm also able to help protect and support and give a bit of sisterhood advice to other women who are having that same kind of problem.
Sydney Film Festival is now on sale. There's over 350 screenings of 288 films from 62 countries over 12 days in 10 venues. From the magnificent State Theatre in the city to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick, there's bound to be a film and venue just right for you. It all happens from June 7 to 18, and you can buy your flexi passes or single tickets right now at sff.org.au. Sydney Film Festival, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
Last week it was the Underground Lovers, and this week we're keeping the dream pop alive with the return of shoegaze pioneers Slow Dive. It's been 22 years and their self-titled comeback is the 2SER feature album this week. We'll dive right in on 2SER all week. 2SER supporters can win copies on Breakfast, Drive and Static. Slow Dive, the feature album on 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. You went to lunch with Alan Jones and asked him for a job. And you described him as charming and cheeky company. But this is the man who said he would like to put Clover Moore and Julia Gillard in a chaff bag and put them out to sea. So how does that sort of behaviour fit in with your description of him?
You speak to anyone who spent time with Alan Jones and they will concur. Personally, he is an incredibly charming individual, the antithesis of the character on air, where he is, you know, let's face it, a lot of his broadcasts could be characterised as being misogynistic, particularly the attack on Julia Gillard, which was just abhorrent. So I'm kind of torn about characters like that in the media because he's an incredibly successful character. But a lot of what he's done for years is bullying, is fake news, has really changed the way the electorate votes. You know, he has a disproportionate amount of influence for a broadcaster. But having spent that time with him, I understand how he does because he emotionally manipulates people.
That's really interesting because when you went on to describe your career in broadcasting, it was sort of like you took the same approach with the opposite political view. There seems to be something that people want in talkback radio, which is strong convictions, strong opinions being put forward to them. I just wonder, why aren't there more shock jocks that are on the other side of the politics?
You see the same thing in America. Fox News always outrates MSNBC, which is the soft lefty version. The expression in talkback radio is that right rates. And the underlying reason for that is that a lot of the right-wing broadcasters peddle in the currency of hate, whereas the left-wing broadcasters are characterised as being bleeding hearts. People have a lot of anger inside of them, and it's somehow cathartic for them to hear someone being very angry and finding an enemy. It's all about heroes and villains. So, for example, when I was working at 2UE and they were trying to train me up to be a shock jock, even though I'm really pretty centrist, they're like, look, you've got to pick and stick, you've got to take a side. You know, it's a coliseum. You've got to pick one side or the other. And they were trying to train me up to be a right-wing shock jock. They were quite explicit about that. They told me that I should really demonise asylum seekers because, you know, people need an enemy. They're having a tough time in their lives and they need someone to look down on and to say, oh no, it's the fault of these people over there. So this is how explicit the training is for shock jocks in talkback radio stations. It was quite horrific and eye-opening.
Talking of shock jocks, this week John Laws made a spate of sexist and misogynistic comments, which don't really merit repeating, but it's fair to say that it seems like there's no changing his mind that women are not much more than sexual objects put on the planet to titillate men. To put it rather bluntly, is there an element of just having to wait for this generation of men to die before things change?
No, no, and no. The reason is I know a lot of men of my age group or younger, so men even who are in their early 40s, who are behaving like men of John Law's era because they were their mentors and heroes when they were coming through. And even though this current crop of executives, there are some tremendous blokes in the industry, there's also a lot who still hold these views that a woman should be at home looking after the children and who are still hiring people for their looks because we don't have proper corporate interview panels in the media industry. People are hired based upon gut. They talk about unconscious bias in the corporate sector, but there's unconscious bias as part of the hiring process every single day in the media and has been for decades.
Your book paints a pretty dire picture of of the media and specifically TV media. But I wonder, what advice would you give to a young woman who is about to embark on a career in journalism?
I recognise this sounds counterintuitive, but I'm a glass half full kind of gal. And I do believe in that Martin Luther King Jr. quote that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I mentor several young women through Women in Media. I just met up with one before I came in to see you. And, you know, I said to her, just understand the structural discrimination and work out strategies around it. Stand up for yourself, be confident, fight the good fight, find a sisterhood of support within the workplace and you will forge forward and you will change it for everybody. And I think that's a really empowering message.
All right, well, that is all we have time for this week on Fourth Estate. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today and congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
The book is available now at all good bookstores. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the Fourth Estate podcast. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes. It helps us to know what you like, what you don't, and what you want more of. And for the three people who wrote us a review, I'm still waiting for you to send me your address so that I can send you a sticker, as I promised. Please get in touch. Drop us a line on Facebook or on Twitter and let us know what you'd like us to cover. On The Money is up next. My name's Olivia Rosenman, and you can catch us at the same time next week.